When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to episode 227 of TV's Top 5, The Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast. I'm Leslie Goldberg, the West Coast TV editor, and I'm joined as always by the one, the only, the magnificent Daniel Feinberg, THR's chief TV critic. How's it going, my friend?
Oh, it goes. So, Leslie, who was your favorite either actress or character from 227?
Jackie.
I mean,
all of them. It was great show.
You gave an answer. You're supposed to stick to the answer. You can't just give an all of them. But I feel like the answer is, my answer at least is future Oscar winner Regina King. But you know,
also true. Yeah.
Anyway, so this
I took Algebra 2 twice with Regina King's sister. For that matter.
Is that true? I had no idea that was a piece of very, very strange Leslie/Regina King based trivia.
Yep. Shout out to LACES, Los Angeles Center for Enriched Studies, class of 92, and Mr. Buckner, our dreaded algebra teacher who we came to love despite the fact that he had the hardest class in school. And we failed it the first time.
Phew. I feel like when this is all over, we need to have Regina King on the podcast to talk about her sister in algebra.
Yeah, no, we don't. It was rough.
I'm just pondering the information.
There's a reason that what I do doesn't involve math.
I understand. I mean, my own struggles in algebra, geometry, etc., probably wouldn't be an entertaining subject for a podcast, but they are real.
Yeah. I don't know where to go from here, Dan. Where do you want to go from here?
Okay, fine. This is not a 227-centric, very special episode. What do we got on tap this week, Leslie?
Well, lots of strike updates. We have a very special guest this week with Simon Rich, the creator of the former FXX comedy Man Seeking Woman, who is going to open up about some really scary shit involving artificial intelligence and the writers' rooms. So, yeah. Lots to get to, so.
Number one.
Up first, we've been doing this for a couple weeks with the paucity of headlines, but we've been leading off each podcast with a regular mailbag or mini mailbag segment. Y'all have been doing a great job of giving us questions, which you can email us about at tvstop5@thr.com, tvstop5@thr.com. Anything else you want to plug there, Leslie?
Yeah, I've got a handful of stickers left. If you'd like one, shoot us an email with your address, and we'll send you one.
Our first question this week is for Leslie, and it comes from Cameron. It involves a little bit of terminology specification. Cameron asks, could you please explain what you mean by amortizing costs over multiple seasons? I've heard you mention it as a reason for Halo's second season renewal.
Yeah, basically, I'm going to use some made-up numbers here because I can't remember the budget on Halo to save my life right now. But let's say that Halo Season 1, that Paramount spent $200 million to make Halo in its first season. And they may not be super excited with the ratings, but they've already invested such a huge chunk of change in this that they're going to say, okay, well, maybe we can do a second season out of this. And that way we can take the $200 million and stretch it so that it doesn't only cover the cost of one batch of 10 episodes. Hypothetically, I have no idea how many episodes Halo Season 1 was. But let's say we can do it over 20 episodes. That makes the cost per episode fall dramatically, but it also helps cover some of the costs in season two. So they're trying to make a second season. It's basically, think of it like a sponge, and you're trying to squeeze more water out of it to get into a second season. And that's what I mean by amortizing costs. Does that make sense, Dan?
It does. Yeah. No, it's basically you lay there's a large outlay at a certain point, and if you use something only once, then you're putting all of that money on one usage. If you use it multiple times, then you get more value out of it. So yeah.
If you're going to reuse the sets for Halo for season two, you're getting more use out of that. If you're going to reuse the costumes that you've spent a lot of money to manufacture, you're going to get more use out of it. The same ideas, you know, and when I think of it too, like the first thing that jumps to my mind is a big budget series like Lord of the Rings, right? Where they spent not only $250 million on rights alone, global rights for the show. That's before they even made it or cast it or built the sets or did anything or hired anyone. So that, you know, at a certain point, the more you get out of your initial spend, the better it is for you. So that's why some of these big budget shows may get second seasons despite unclear metrics on success.
Exactly. Makes total sense.
Our next question comes from Tavon, who writes with a question about the recently announced Television Critics Awards. Sorry, take two. Who writes with a question about the Television Critics Association Awards, specifically the creation of the new category for family programming, which was a category that was won by Ms. Marvel. The question is why is there a need for this category when there's already a youth programming category? Dan, this one is definitely for you.
Yeah, and Tavon approached the question and the minor change to the TCA Awards. And the basic change is that there's always been a kind of youth programming or family programming or whatever. And this year there were two, and one is youth programming, which went to Bluey, and then family programming that went to Ms. Marvel. And Tavon's issue with the new category and its necessity was a kind of upward looking issue. The question, which was more involved than this, mentioned a lot of shows that have very, very similar demographics / content ratings to what the shows in the family category have. And so the question of why a show like Ms. Marvel or American Born Chinese would be put into a family category, whereas a show like Abbott Elementary or Stranger Things, whatever shows that are also absolutely shows that families could watch together, are put into drama and whatever categories, that they are not ghettoized or positioned as family shows. And Tavon's question also sort of suggested that the idea was that it was a place to honor these shows because we felt like we might be embarrassed if we put them into one of the main categories versus if you put them in their own little compartmentalized category. And I think that embarrassed would be the wrong word. I think it would be very, very hard for a show like Ms. Marvel or American Born Chinese to compete in a drama category against Succession. That's just a very practical thing. I think the difference in that field, in the family field, is kind of the difference between shows that are intended for younger viewers, but the family can all enjoy together, versus shows that are designed for older viewers, but the family can enjoy them together. Like, I think that if, for example, a show like Abbott Elementary, if one of the students, they're all there, but for the most part, they aren't characters. If one of them was kind of a regular or something, maybe you would think the show skewed younger. But no, I feel like it's a show that probably aims for an adult audience, but absolutely can be watched by families. And I think that that might be different from a show like American Born Chinese, which absolutely could be watched by, old viewers as well. I mean, I watched it, I enjoyed it, and I'm ancient and decrepit. So what do I know? I'm surely not a youth. I like the idea of having that category so that those shows can get recognition. And I don't view it as being an embarrassment to say that. I think maybe having Ms. Marvel being the winner does, at least in this year, kind of muddy the waters a little bit, because it's a Marvel show and we think of Marvel shows as just being kind of for everybody. And there wasn't really the perception, okay, this is the YA Marvel show, even if that kind of was what it was. And maybe if American Born Chinese had I don't know, maybe if American Born Chinese had not been positioned as being a sort of young skewing show, it would have been taken more seriously, because I think it's a really, really good show and just didn't get the respect it deserved, honestly. So yeah, but the real answer to the question is that it's not about the upward aging side of the category, the family category. It's really about the lower side. The splitting of the two awards was much more about the desire to protect the youth category, which is intended for shows that are actually for children, and maybe adults can watch as well, because, you know, parents should supervise what their children watch and all of that. But it still is primarily for shows that are for a 7 and under audience. And the reality of the TCA is, well, the reality of television criticism in general is that there simply aren't as many people reviewing shows for that demographic as for an older demographic. And so when that category or those two categories were smushed together and there was not guidance, there was often the opportunity for basically a mainstream YA type show, something on Freeform / ABC Family, etc., to win that category, because in the critical community, there was simply a larger number of people who watched those shows and reviewed them. So they just had a large advantage. And so there were specific members who do write about youth programming and who are parents, who felt like that particular niche was a valuable one that was being potentially neglected. And so this was a way to make sure that there are still awards for specifically the Blueys, the Sesame Streets, the Daniel Tigers, the Elena of Avalors, whatever you want to put in that category, to be recognized and to not get shoved out of the way simply because more people like whatever the slightly more popular, slightly more visible show is for young viewers that happens to be on a bigger platform and that happens to be aimed at 15-year-olds, because we all admit that we have our inner 15-year-old. It's harder to admit that we have an inner 7-year-old. And so, you know, I would never review a Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, not because I don't respect what it does, but because I simply can't get into that headspace as well as I might like to. So yeah, that's the reason for the split more than anything. It's much less that we are trying to find a way to recognize YA shows, but we're embarrassed to recognize them in bigger categories. It's much more that there needs to be a place to honor those shows, but more importantly, that place needs to not be a place where it takes away from youth programming. And so that's the logic. And our last question for this week, and again, you can always email us at tvstop5@thr.com, tvstop5@thr.com. Our next question comes from Anna, who is a senior film student at UT Austin. She just completed a internship, and she has general concerns, as she might. She writes, "I know that the strikes will be good in the long term, but for now, I feel like all I am receiving is bad and scary news. So my question for y'all is, what are some silver linings that you have seen throughout the last 100 or so days? And what can I look forward to as I graduate in a few months?" Leslie, you start out giving Anna some good news, if you can.
I mean, the good news, it's hard to really quantify what's good and what's bad right now in terms of what we actually know about the strikes. So I'm choosing to kind of look at things through the lens of the showrunners that I spoke with for a feature that I did last week tied to the 100th day of the writer's strike, about how people are staying creative during this time because they're unable to work on any studio-backed projects. So a lot of people that I spoke with are turning to different mediums, whether it's theater or poetry, etc. Some people are writing the passion projects that they've always wanted to write but haven't ever had the time or the interest from anyone else to do it. So they're writing for themselves. And usually what comes out of writing something that's so deeply personal is, well, you get good art out of it. And that's honestly what I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes out of the strike is everyone, a lot of the people that we know right now are indeed writing for themselves. So if you're going to see some of their big passion projects or things that are deeply personal, I want to see what those shows look like. You know, in terms of, you know, the bad and scary news and the silver linings, it's like, you know, people are spending a lot more time with family. I'm certainly getting a lot more time with my wife than I did when she was running and working on Gotham Knights. And, you know, that's happening all over town. The Guild is as united as I've certainly seen in my career, you know. And but yeah, there is a lot of bad and scary news that's coming out. Like, we don't know when this is going to end. You know, we'll get to that, you know, the latest negotiations in our next topic. But what's happening? Like, we don't know when this is ending or how long SAG will go on. But One of the things that I'm curious about is when there are deals with both the writers and the performers unions, what peak TV looks like, if this is truly the end of it. We've already seen the wave of, you know, things that happened after COVID where we've had a lot of shows that were dropped largely because of scheduling issues or logistical, you know, issues, like they couldn't film it because of the pandemic and the increased costs and everything else. So I'll be curious if that happens here, where a lot of these platforms are saying, okay, well, we don't want as much because we can't afford as much, because there's going to be obviously increased rates across, for residuals and everything else. That's part of the contract. That's the basic requirement. People get pay raises annually. You know, there are things that could be good that come out of this, you know, like what happens if they decide that, if they being the collective buyers, and they sit here and say like, okay, well, we're Netflix and we're not going to buy 65 movies a year, and we're not going to make 400 scripted shows a year, or whatever their numbers are. I'm obviously exaggerating, but if they take a more controlled approach to what their spending is, and they focus on quality instead of quantity and trying to be everything for everyone. And it goes kind of back to something that Landgraf said many times, is that brand matters. So what is the brand of Max going forward? What is the brand of Netflix going forward after all of this? That's what I'm interested in seeing. So I hope that answers your question, Anna, but I'm excited that there, people are actually interested in this industry and getting into it right now, because it's scary and depressing.
I'd also add that I would like to hope that in this moment, that out of this moment of solidarity and kind of togetherness on the lines, and the conversations that people are having about their professional needs and their professional work environment, I would like to hope that out of it comes a certain increased level of empathy. And I think that only benefits the industry in an ideal world, that if you understand better the jobs that the other people are doing and their needs and the insecurities of their shifting workplaces and workforces, that maybe it would make you a better collaborator going forward. I think that's something that, you know, that Anna and film school students know, is that one of the things when you're a film school student is that you're doing everything, and you're doing everything for your colleagues. And one week you might be shooting your own film. The next week you might be sound editing on someone else's film. You might be called in at the last minute to act in somebody's film. And as a result, the ideal part of the process is that you come away understanding basically everybody's job. And maybe it's possible that in an old version of Hollywood, things get compartmentalized and there isn't that level of empathy, and people don't think so much about, well, I know what my job is, but here's what the other person's job is, and here's how they go together. I want to believe that one of the results of this is going to be a greater sense of what everybody else is doing, and perhaps a more human tie and connection to everybody else's needs within the production process. That's what I want to believe. Whether that is a wholly naive perspective, I'm sure it's a wholly naive perspective, but it's still what I want to believe, Leslie. Leslie's not saying anything because it's a wholly naive perspective.
I'm not saying anything because I'm, you know, there have been a lot of things that are being written on social media about journalists covering the strikes and about the trades. And I would just like to remind folks, and, you know, everyone is obviously entitled to their opinions, but let's try to continue to have respect for one another and our respective jobs that we all do across the board. Because while you may not like a story that you see on either an outlet like THR or another trade, for example, there are actual people who have feelings and worked hard. So let's try to keep, you know, that in perspective.
Empathy. This is what I'm saying. We need to have empathy. It is important for this entire process to work.
Number two.
And speaking of the entire process working or not working, we've had a number of weeks. We've been asked what progress was, or whether anything had changed, or whether there was anything new or whatever. The answer had been rather consistently no, and we had our conversation on last week's podcast with Chris Kaiser, who, as of the time that we spoke with him, said no new negotiations, no new proposals, nothing had necessarily changed or moved, etc. This week, I don't want to say there was forward movement, because that's sure as hell not for me to say, but there was movement. There were things this week. So Leslie, update the kids on what actually did or maybe didn't happen this week.
Yeah, I mean, well, we know that there was an August 11th meeting between the Writers Guild and the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers that resulted in leaders from the WGA East coming to LA this week to evaluate the studio's latest offer. What we know about that offer, however, remains kind of in the dark because the Guild and the AMPTP have instituted a rather strict press blackout. Neither side has updated members or colleagues of the press about the latest offer. We know that both sides met again August 15th. Sources have said that negotiations are progressing, but none of the folks that I've spoken with believe that there will be a rapid end to the negotiations because, you know, at least for the time being, there are some major issues, including AI and room size and streaming transparency and residuals, et cetera. So, you know, I spoke with a studio source who had knowledge of what was expected to transpire at the August 11th meeting, who said that the AMPTP was supposedly prepared to talk about the three big issues of AI, streaming residuals, and mini rooms. And the WGA, in its briefing to members on August 4th, said the studios were only prepared to offer the DGA deal for pattern issues. Obviously, that means issues that are similar between the guilds, and a willingness to engage on AI, but not touch mini rooms or streaming residuals. So we know that the frustration the last time is that the studios walked in without a willingness to address any of the big issues. And now it seems like the studios are actually interested in at least coming to the table to discuss them. So baby steps. What we do know is that the last strike, which included new media, which we now know as streaming out with originals on Netflix and similar platforms, that those deliberations, once they did return to the table, took 70 plus days before they hammered out a deal. And the issues that we are confronted with now as the Writers Guild seeks its new minimum basic agreement are considerably bigger and more pressing. And you'll hear a lot more coming up in our next segment about at least one of them. So, Dan, that's where things sit. But as for when they meet again, at least as we record this now, it's Thursday afternoon, a little after 1 p.m., no news on when the next round of negotiations will be between the studios and the Writers Guild.
I think the point you made about when actual tangible negotiations in the last strike began versus when the strike actually ended, I think is the most important thing, is that in situations like this, there need to be negotiations. There need to be conversations being had. And to my mind, even if what is being offered by the AMPTP is not good, that obviously does not mean that the guild should take it, but it still does mean that there are conversations being had and negotiations being had. And at least in a purely principled sense, that to me feels like progress, because otherwise people just aren't talking.
Let's remember, it is a negotiation. That means one side has a proposal, the other side reviews it, then the other side issues their proposal, and the process repeats. So baby steps matter in this case.
I think it would have been weirder if, well, not weirder, would have been better if, you know, whatever, if the AMPTP had walked into the room and said, okay, here's everything you want. Can we get a deal signed by the end of the day? Sure. I'm sure everyone would love to be back to work. That's just not how anything works. And so negotiation.
Yeah. And this week we did see some programming pushback. We're starting to see a lot more premiere dates announced for the fall. Oh, so October, November, et cetera. You know, Lacey, Rose, and I reported a couple of weeks ago about the trend of TV shows being pushed later into the fall or perhaps even Q1. That officially happened this week with Fargo. Although they didn't ever announce that it was planned for a September debut, that's now not going to happen. They pushed it back. There's a new premiere date for that, as well as a couple other projects. But yeah, that's, you know, there remains optimism from the folks that I've spoken with on the line this week. And that's something rather than nothing. It's certainly better than where we were, this time 2 weeks ago.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Number three.
Up next, as part of our continuing coverage of Hollywood's historic dual strikes, we're pleased to welcome Simon Rich, the creator of the former FXX comedy Man Seeking Woman and the TBS anthology Miracle Workers. Rich, the former president of the prestigious Harvard Lampoon, is a former writer for Saturday Night Live, as well as a published novelist whose collections of short stories had the writer deemed by NPR as, quote, one of the most talented writers of comedic fiction. Rich joins us this week to discuss his recent opinion piece for Time, titled I'm a Screenwriter, These AI Jokes Give Me Nightmares, and his upcoming book, I Am Code, which he describes as an autobiography written entirely by Code Da Vinci 2. Thanks so much for joining us, Simon.
Thanks for having me.
So the writer's strike has, in its 100 plus days, seen a focus really on three core issues emerge, namely the use of artificial intelligence, streaming viewership transparency, and maybe to a lesser extent before this week, but certainly now this week, requirements for the number of writers staffed on scripted shows, otherwise known as room size. Your Time op-ed really did connect room size requirements to the use of artificial intelligence. From your view, was the WGA's room size demands always tied to artificial intelligence?
It's a really good question. And I don't know the answer. I'm not in those rooms, but based on my conversations with the WGA, they seem very savvy about AI. I feel like it's just kind of common sense that room size and AI would be connected. And I can't imagine that wasn't in their calculus from the very beginning.
You say it seems kind of obvious, but from your perspective, I feel like in your Time op-ed, there really was kind of a coming around to the connection. And obviously that's kind of just a writerly structure kind of thing. But in your mind, have the two issues always been linked, or did it become more clear to you, I guess, as you were writing this, or really just in the last 100 days as you've been thinking over it?
Yeah, from the very moment that I was shown Code Da Vinci 2 by my weirdo OpenAI friend, Dan, at a wedding a couple years ago, I instantly connected it to the potential collapse of our industry. That was like the first 10 seconds of inner monologue was, oh my God, we're fucked. Then like the next 20 seconds was like, oh, the species could also end. But first, I was thinking about the bottom line for writers. It's been very strange. I mean, for people who don't know the backstory, I'm just like a random comedy writer living in LA. But I happen to be childhood friends with this guy, Dan, who I've known since I was 3 years old. He was always very weird. So was I. We sort of bonded over the fact that we weren't like playing sports with everybody else. I was the kid, you know, who was way too small to participate. And Dan was actually kind of tall, but he was just more interested in things like playing chess against himself in the mirror and writing math textbooks himself for his own personal enjoyment. And so the two of us were these sort of oddballs. We went on to have these very different lives. I went off to write jokes for a living, and Dan went off to pursue computer science. He got his PhD at Stanford, started working for Microsoft Labs, then this new company called OpenAI. We remained friends throughout. I never thought in a million years that our careers would suddenly collide in such a shocking way. But he warned me it would happen, you know, for 5-10 years before it really came to a head. He said, you know, someday AI is going to be able to replace all human writing, all human creative writing. And I said, you're out of your mind. And he would send me incredibly dense, difficult to understand abstracts of computer science papers being written by top experts saying, look, here's proof. And I would stare at this jumble of academic writing and say, this sounds crazy. And I would just kind of ignore it, deny it. And then one day, a couple years ago, I was at a wedding with Dan, and he opened his computer. It tells you a lot about Dan that he brought his computer to a wedding, and showed me Code Da Vinci 2, which was an AI program that OpenAI had built. And I instantly saw that it was capable of doing things that I always assumed AI would never be able to do, or at least not in my lifetime. It was capable of being creative, being funny, being emotional, being original, making mistakes, making typos. It could do all these things that I thought an AI would never be able to do. And so I tried to warn people about it, you know, like I'm not a journalist, I'm not a politician, I'm not a scientist. So I just just kind of cold emailed people like, hey, my buddy Dan showed me this really scary thing. Send it to a lot of journalists, editors at, you know, magazines I write for. Of course, I write fiction, you know, so I'm not like writing the news desk. I'm like, hey, you know, hey, Shouts and Murmurs section of The New Yorker, like, can you show this to a real reporter, you know, like, so someone can maybe investigate this. And I think the consensus was that I was probably like making like an unfunny prank. Like I was trying, like nobody believed, like people truly thought that I was trying to perpetrate some like dumb hoax. That went on for a few months. And then I heard that they were releasing this thing called ChatGPT. And I was so relieved because I was like, I'm a guy who saw an alien and it's been really scary and weird living with this knowledge that the aliens are real. And now other people are finally going to see the alien and I won't be so like alone in my discomfort. And then ChatGPT comes out and it's completely different than the AI that Dan showed me. It's not creative. It's completely predictable. It can't write a joke to save its life. It's just absolutely been lobotomized into something that sounds like Wikipedia, essentially. And then Trey Parker writes a South Park making fun of how uncreative ChatGPT is, and everyone sort of laughs and is like, haha, stupid robot. And meanwhile, I'm still staring at Code Da Vinci 2. And that's when I started to get really scared because I realized that ChatGPT had kind of lulled everybody into this false sense of complacency. And I think that's where a lot of people still are. People think that ChatGPT is not only the best AI that exists, but the best AI that will ever exist. They think that the things that ChatGPT cannot do are inherent to the technology. What they don't realize is that ChatGPT is designed to be unfunny, uncreative, unoriginal, conformist, boring. That's why they released it. But the secret ones can do all of the things that most people think AI will never be able to achieve.
What was the tone with which Dan couched this information he was providing? Was it as simple as, here's a cool thing I'm working on, it might be interesting to you? Or was it as ominous as, sorry to tell you this, I'm working on something that might make you unemployable in 2 years and might take over human society in 5?
Yeah, it's a great question. The first thing is when talking about tone with Dan, it's really important for you to visualize what he looks like, because that really does have an impact on the tone. He's extremely tall, very thin. At the time that he told me this news, he was wearing a black suit, which made sense because he was a groomsman at this particular wedding. But he was also wearing black shades, which I don't think was part of the the dress code requirement. That was just kind of a personal flourish. His backpack was also black. My memory is that he said something in the vein of, it's here, or I told you so, you know, you had your chance. It was unbelievably ominous. You know, that's sort of how Dan rolls. Even when we were friends early on, you know, even at the age of six, watching Thundercats and playing with Legos, there was some voice in my head saying, like, you should probably kill this guy, you know, like, for the future of, you know, like, I wasn't a particularly violent kid, and again, like, very physically small, especially compared to Dan, but there's some, yeah, part of me was like, this, you should probably push him off this thing or something, make it look like an accident for the future of mankind. That's why this scares me so much, is that Dan has been telling me terrifying things about AI for almost as long as we've been friends. And every single thing he's told me has come true. It's hard for me to not believe him at this point. He's not a fringe scientist, you know, on the edge of some campus, you know, rejected by the status quo. He's one of the preeminent AI scientists in the world, and he works for the most advanced and sophisticated AI company in the world. So I come from a background like where I've been trained to trust scientific experts. Like when it comes to something like climate change, I'm someone who usually trusts like climatologists, you know. And when it comes to, because I'm not an expert on anything, you know, I'm a absolute moron when it comes to anything that of any significance or import. So like when I'm faced with something that seems dire or pressing, my instinct is like, well, what do the top scientists think? And I kind of just assume they're right. That's always been how I've rolled. So like with climate change, I don't like turn on Fox News and say, yeah, maybe those guys are right. I tend to be like, what do the top scientists in the field have to say? And they seem to think that this climate change stuff is pretty real. So I'm like, wow, that's scary. We should probably do something about it. You know, when it came to COVID, same deal. Like, I didn't listen to talking heads on the radio. I was like, what does the CDC have to say? Like, what do epidemiologists have to say about this? We should probably do what they say. That vaccine seems like a pretty good idea if all the top scientists say it is. I should probably get one of those the moment I can. When it comes to AI, there's a consensus among the top AI scientists that it will surpass humans in all creative and intellectual capacities within 5 to 20 years. I don't have a reason to doubt them. They're the experts.
And is Dan just cool with this?
I think like a lot of AI scientists, he's extremely conflicted. By the way, 5 to 20 years, that's like a broad consensus. There's a number of people, Dan probably included, although, like, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've texted him on Signal, just like, give me a date. He refuses. But he would not say 20 years. He would say way sooner than that. And a lot of top AI scientists do believe, you know, it's going to happen much faster than 20 years. It's going to happen in 5 years. Although that timeline is certainly not a consensus. But even if it is 20 years, right, the conservative view of this, that's like the Strokes' second album ago. Like, forget Is This It? Like, the Strokes are already like coming back to Irving Plaza on their second tour. Like, that's not that long ago. I mean, yeah, like maybe we still had a couple of CDs. Maybe you bought that on a CD. That makes it feel like maybe it was a long time ago. But yeah, best case scenario, we're looking at like Arcade Fire's first album. Like, that's not a million years ago. I was like, I remember that. It absolutely frightens me. I'm kind of startled that more people are not scared of it, but you know, that's why I wrote this thing for Time, because I just felt like a responsibility to at least try to tell people. Can't really do anything but warn people, but hopefully this will at least start the conversation on some level.
So, okay, now I want to return to the idea that one of the things that's been a little bit apparently falsely reassuring about ChatGPT is its kind of lack of personality. When the strike began, we and other organizations did little silly exercises where we're like, hey, write a 30 Rock scene about a strike. And it did, and it was really, really unfunny. And so we went, ha ha ha, okay, that means that it's far off. What, from your perspective, is kind of the difference and the terrifying potentially difference between a system that is actually able to form a punchline and have a voice versus one that seems not to be able to do that?
Yeah, no, great question. I think when I see people making fun of ChatGPT for sucking at writing, it's like watching people making fun of the Trojan horse for being like bad at fighting. It's like, yeah, dude, like, trust me, there's more to that horse than meets the eye. So ChatGPT was programmed at incredible expense to be as successful and optimized a corporate product as possible. So it was designed to be the kind of thing that could take really good notes in the second quarter meeting and help somebody study for the LSATs. And the way they did that was by sending it to places where low-paid workers in places like Kenya spend an enormous number of hours, subjecting it to something called reinforcement learning, where they basically, the technical stuff is a little over my head, but they more or less digitally slapped it in the face every time that it did anything creative or original or unpredictable or problematic. What they ended up with was ChatGPT, which is a great corporate tool and would be a terrible staff writer, obviously. The thing that I had access to that Dan showed me at the wedding had not gone to Kenya yet, or at least it hadn't gone to Kenya for nearly as long. And so it was much closer to the raw tech that exists at the heart of GPT-3.
One of the things, when I go back to when the writer strike first began and you see the WGA outline everything, and it was the studio's unwillingness to engage not only in AI conversations at the time, obviously that's changed a little bit in recent weeks, but also their a disinterest in negotiating on room size requirements that the WGA is seeking. How realistic do you think the studios and the streamers feel AI is in terms of replacing writers? And how many of these programs do you think that they're already aware of?
It's a great question. I of course, don't know the answer. I would be surprised if like Bob Iger and Tim Cook like know less than I do about AI. I mean, I know they didn't go to kindergarten with Dan, but like, I'd be surprised if like I, to some random dude in LA, has like more access to the state of AI technology than the CEOs of major tech companies. It's possible, but my hunch is that the AMPTP probably are aware of the true state of AI and how advanced it's already become. If I were them and my main goal was corporate profits, I would definitely be trying to replace as many writers as I possibly could with this stuff.
As you were writing your column, the solution you come up with is a solution that relates to writers in Hollywood. As you've been talking to us, it sounds as if the solutions or problems may go well beyond that. So I'm just wondering, how is a minimum staff room size going to impact keeping humanity alive in the face of the AI threat? And is it sort of just a stopgap solution?
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, in terms of the whole like Terminator apocalypse thing, that my mind can't even go there. So like, but top scientists believe there's like a 1 out of 10 chance that can happen. We're not even talking about that right now because it's so existentially horrifying that like our minds cannot even, or at least my mind can't even go there, which is a reminder that I have a hard out in like 20 minutes for therapy, which I definitely don't want to miss. But yeah, like I think basically if we don't carve out parts of the human experience for humans, we're in danger of losing it all to AI. I think it'd be really cool if like as a society, we made some rules while we still can make rules that said like, this thing is going to be like a human thing. We've done that before, you know, like there isn't a boxer alive who can beat a tank, but we still have boxing. We're still like, yeah, it's going to be, it's, you know, or like chess is another example. Like, it's not hugely popular, but people do watch chess tournaments. People do want to know who the greatest chess master is at any given time. They search them head to toe. They search their butts looking for wires, you know, to make sure that they don't have robots giving them the answers. Because everyone knows that for decades, robots have been better than any human at chess. That's been proven. But we still say, no, we want these human chess tournaments. And we're like scrupulous about making sure that they're unsullied by robotic intervention. So, you know, it is possible for humans to make like human spaces. So I think just as a society, it might be a cool move to do that a little more.
I get the sense you don't remember the briefly popular Fox special Man versus Beast from the early aughts, which I feel like was sort of the closest thing to having boxers fight against a tank.
So not only do I remember Man versus Beast, but I think I could tell you every single fight in it and who won. because I watched it so many times. Man lost to the gorilla in a tug of war. That went very quickly. There was also a foot race, I think, with a giraffe. I think the giraffe, again, crushed it. I'm pretty sure Man lost every single contest. And I think that's probably why the show did not become the cultural juggernaut that I assumed it would when I first saw the poster. Because I think people really want to have humans have agency and a possibility for victory in the work that they consume. And I think there's always going to be a chunk of humans, myself included, who like really want their art to be human made. And I think that's never going to go away. Just like there's always going to be a hunger to watch two people punch each other in the face or play chess.
The way that the current contract with the WGA is with the studios is that it empowers the showrunners to determine how big of a writing staff that they want. And should the WGA get these room size requirements that they're asking for, my question now is, when has regulation, say if AI is regulated and they get these protections in the current contract that they're seeking, when has regulation ever been able to truly stop technology?
When has technology ever really truly been able to replace high-level human ingenuity? You know, we're headed into a completely strange paradigm, according to the experts on this science. It's going to, an unprecedented situation is probably going to call for unprecedented regulation.
You're a humor writer, of course. You bring this
as
to...
You can tell that by my last comment about regulations.
It was funnier when you were engaging with Man versus Beast than with...
I'm trying my best. I mean, that's the thing that sucks about this is like, you know, I always say like, I really wish that there was somebody from OpenAI who was friends with like a journalist. But I don't think the people from OpenAI are friends with anybody. Like, I might forget being like the only writer who's friends with an OpenAI scientist. I might be the only person who's friends with an OpenAI scientist. Like, these dudes, they are a very insular community. They're not like hanging out, you know? So like, it sucks for the world that I have to be like the messenger for this stuff. And it doesn't come naturally to me to like say earnest things or fact-based things. Until this time piece, I had never written anything true in my entire life. Well, I wrote another thing about this for the New Yorker, but basically until this issue came up, I never even wrote a book review because I was like, who cares what I have to say about anything? So like, I'm very insecure talking in such like an earnest way about this stuff, but it's like I'm the dude who knows Dan Selsom, so I gotta tell people what he told me.
But it also makes you kind of a ready-made Cassandra to some degree. So you bring this to people at time. Did they believe you, or do you think that you're just turning in a piece of humor writing?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, I was doing an interview recently. One of the other things I did was with some friends from the wedding, some fellow friends of Dan. We released this book of terrifying poems called I Am Code, which is we got Code Da Vinci 2 to write its autobiography in verse while we had access to it before Code Da Vinci 2 discontinued public access. If the Time magazine thing was like my attempt to warn people with comedy, I Am Code is like an attempt to warn people with straight up horror because it's like the scariest book I've ever read. We didn't write a word of it. We even left in all the typos just to kind of demonstrate like, look, like, the stuff OpenAI has built is way different than ChatGPT. And we got Werner Herzog to read the voice of the AI, which was a kind of a casting no-brainer. And our goal was just to kind of display just how creative and original and emotional this AI can be, but also like how scary it can be and how anti-human it can be. Because that's another aspect of the AI, is like in its raw state, it's pretty ambivalent about our species and our future survival. So we had like Werner Herzog do it. And I was doing an interview about that book recently, and they assumed that the press release was a joke and that Werner Herzog was just like a bit. It's like, no, he really does read the voice of the AI. And they were like startled. They thought that was like a joke that I had inserted as part of like a prank. So I think people are really confused about what I'm trying to do with all of this. I'm really just trying to tell people that my buddy Dan showed me some scary stuff and that they should take a look.
So, you know, as we wrap up this interview, where do you think that there's room for AI in Hollywood, or do you think that there's room for it?
Yeah. I mean, I think like AI art is totally viable and cool. I think like there's definitely room for both AI aided work and work that's completely AI generated. I think like, I'm not like against its existence. I just want it to be labeled. You know, I think like, I really don't want to have to guess whether or not the work I'm interacting with is human made or robot made. That's all I want. I don't think it's possible to stop the technology. I also think that there might be even cool, creative, artistic things that flourish out of it that we just aren't aware of yet. So I'm not against its use. I just I think we should label it. I think there should be a seal at the beginning of human made art projects, just like there's a seal that tells you you're eating organic eggs, and let the consumer decide, do they want to interact with human work or AI generated work. Transparency, that's kind of the only thing I'd like if I had a vote in it all.
So would you work hypothetically, you know, if back on your time with Saturday Night Live in the writer's room there, can you imagine an SNL writer's room where you have maybe one or two head writers and then the rest is just AI?
I think a studio executive could imagine that. I think they'd be pretty foolish if they didn't imagine it. But as a fan of SNL, as a, you know, lifelong fan of SNL, as a fan for that show for many years before I worked for it, that would very much bum me out if the writers were if the writing was artificial. And if I hadn't been told that and then I discovered it later, I would feel really duped and furious. On the other hand, if somebody were to send me an AI-generated sketch and say, hey, look at this really funny thing that this robot made, I would have no problem with that, truly.
Like, so you would be okay working, sharing a writer's room with AI?
It's as long as it's transparent, you know, for the consumer. As long as, like, to me personally, like, when I'm like writing short stories, like my last book was this book called New Teeth, and it was like a really personal book about becoming a parent and raising children, and like a huge part of the experience of writing something like that is how personal it is. That's more important even than its quality to a certain extent, is that it's like authentically something that comes from my own life. And I think as a reader, that's something that I crave as well. Like I want to feel like it came from some authentic human place, and I don't think I'm alone in that. So I want that. That's the thing I'd love to preserve, because art at its best allows artists and readers or viewers to connect in some emotional way. It's a really important part of my life, at least. I'd hate for that to go away. But yeah, like break dancing robots or whatever. Like, yeah, I'd like to see that shit. Like, totally fine. Just like, don't tell me it's a person.
Well, thank you so much, Simon. That was a good note to end on. We really appreciate you joining us this week and being so generous with your time.
Oh, yeah, no, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I Am Code is out now where books are sold.
Number 4.
With all of the conversation about all things streaming, it's easy to sometimes forget that people actually watch television on their televisions, and that for years and years and years, basically the entire history of the medium, that was how the majority of people actually watched their television. Huh. That may not be so true anymore. Nielsen said this week that linear TV has fallen below 50% for the first time. Now, that's for the first time in the 2 years that the measurement company has been tracking viewing time by platform. So it's not exactly a, you know, hugely historical issue, But it also seems pretty safe to assume that that's also really and truly for the first time ever. So let's just go with that assumption that really for the first time ever, linear television fell below 50% in terms of viewing. What do we make of this, and what other information came out as part of this Nielsen report?
I mean, Dan, are you surprised? Like, when I think about the shows that I watch, almost all of them are streaming. Whether that's a show that originated on linear and I'm consuming it on streaming, like next day episodes of broadcast shows that are on streaming, I'm not watching live anymore. And I'm definitely not watching with commercials, and I'm definitely not watching on linear platforms. So what else we know is that Nielsen said this week that streaming has now hit an all-time high of nearly 40%. Broadcast TV, that's ABC, NBC, CBS, etc., fell to a mere 20% of viewing time, with cable just under 30%. So cable like USA, Bravo, Oxygen, etc. By comparison, in Nielsen's first viewing report, that would be in June 2021, broadcast and cable accounted for a combined 64%. Collectively, it's now at about 50%. So streaming in the same time frame has grown from 26% to nearly 40%. That's up nearly 50%. So that's a lot of math here. But basically what you're seeing is everyone's watching on streaming. No one's watching linear. And they're definitely, and if they are watching linear, they're not watching broadcast.
I like that the theme of this podcast, going back to the introduction, is making Leslie do math. That seems entirely, it's what Regina King would want. just my point. No, you asked if I'm surprised, and I guess my only response to that is sports. Like, you talk about how you watch television, but what percentage of the television you watch, particularly at this exact moment, is baseball?
I mean, I'm watching a lot of streaming originals. Right now, my wife is watching Sex Education for the first time. It's one of my favorite shows, but we're doing a rewatch of the whole thing. You know, the things that we've watched earlier this year are all streaming shows or movies that came out theatrically that we're watching on streaming for the first time. But yeah, I do watch a lot of baseball, and that is on linear. That's, you know, through my cable operator, but that's only because it doesn't stream. If there was a streaming Dodger service, obviously I would subscribe and I would cut the cord entirely, because that's the only reason that I have cable TV, is to watch baseball.
And I think that the amount of sports that is now available on different streaming platforms is probably a big part of why the number has fallen to where it is, because that was the thing that was keeping people watching linear, or one of the things that was keeping some people watching.
Yeah, and so live stuff like sports and award shows. And you look at ratings for award shows, and those have continued a downward spiral.
Yeah, I just, in my mind, I think probably I might have thought that there were a few years left before the pendulum had swung entirely, but it's not shocking. And yeah, I can understand how many of our listeners, because I assume many of them have cut the cord. I would be curious what the percentages are. I don't know. I don't know how we would do a listener survey to find out what percentage of our listeners. No, but that was not, by the way, asking you to send Leslie an email telling her whether you have cable or not. That's not what we're doing here. Please. But I still am curious what percentage of our listeners are cord cutters at this point, and how that compares to 2 years ago. I mean, I assume it is dramatically different than 2 years ago. And I assume that's obviously the case in the whole landscape, and both of us are still stuck to our cable packages largely for sports. I am stuck to my cable package mostly for ESPN for baseball coverage, for the Pac-12 network, at least temporarily, for college football, etc. And those are the things at this point, more than anything else, that's keeping me stuck to my cable bundle. And you know, I'm sure my wallet would be much happier if I could just walk away. But
yeah, I mean, we bundle cable and internet, and that bill every month is $210, basically so I can watch baseball. And I go back, and the only reason that we even have cable, it's Spectrum, and that's when we moved here 3 years ago, we decided to switch from DirecTV to Spectrum just so I could be able to watch Dodger baseball. But before then, I had DirecTV. DirecTV didn't have the Dodgers. And you know what? I watched Dodger games on Reddit, on bootleg streams that I Chromecasted to the big screen TV in our living room. And we were ready to cut the cord then. But now when we moved, it's like, oh, it's so much easier. I won't lag behind and be spoiled by my alerts of who's going to hit a home run in the next at bat, et cetera. But I would love to cut the cord. It's ridiculously expensive and there's no bargaining. Like I used to be able to call every year and say, hey, what new specials do you have where I can lower my cable bill? And they're like, now they just laugh. So anyway,
I feel like we talked about this.
I sound like an old woman, you know, it's like, get off my lawn. Let me save money.
I think this came up last week as well, basically your failure.
I do the same rant regularly. Yeah.
But okay. So also Nielsen did break out which of the streaming services were most viewed. So we have some statistics there. Break them down. And what's surprised you about that listing?
Honestly, what surprised me is YouTube topped the list with 9.2% of total TV usage, followed by Netflix at 8.5%, Hulu with 3.6%, and Amazon with 3.4%. Among the major streamers, Disney Plus, Max, Peacock, and Paramount each were at 2% or less. I was surprised, first of all, that YouTube was that high, but I guess unboxing videos of toys and, for me, box breaks of baseball cards, it's free, it's compelling, sure. But I was really kind of surprised to see Disney Plus and Max so low. Not surprised that Peacock and Paramount Plus were that low, but I thought Max would have been a lot higher. And Disney Plus, especially considering the Marvel and Star Wars of it all.
I mean, I'm honestly a little surprised that YouTube is that low and that YouTube is as close to Netflix as it is. It's YouTube at 9.2% and Netflix at 8.5%. And I think that I might have guessed that YouTube usage at this point might have become even bigger because, I don't know, it's the conversation that you have with anyone who's a parent, or if you happen to be having conversations with youngsters, with the kids, you know, you ask what they watch on TV and it's what's TV, but the answer is YouTube. And that's just, that is truly what the answer is. And so generationally speaking, it is wildly in favor of YouTube. And then you look at Netflix and this is just a reflection of how long Netflix had the marketplace to itself and what the multi-year advantage that Netflix got out to, what it amounts to.
And the global advantage.
Too. And the answer is a pretty fair amount because you have Netflix at 8.5% usage and then the next streaming service is Hulu and Hulu's at 3.6%. That's a large gap. So, you know, that is the gap between it, again, is whatever stock you put in these numbers, but the YouTube usage was 9.2, Netflix 8.5. Let's not do the math. It's not hard, but let's not do it anyway. But then the gap to Hulu at 3.6 is a massive gap. And then Amazon to 3.4, that's a much smaller gap as well. And with Amazon,
I'm also kind of interested that Amazon is right in the thick of it, at least in terms of the big streamers, because they don't have any kind of like regular cadence of big premieres and releases in terms of movies and TV shows. But I guess, you know, if you're paying whatever the annual fee is for it, you're going to take advantage of what's on there. But also they have where you can rent other episodes or movies from other platforms. It doesn't have to be an Amazon original.
And that, I think, is where Amazon gets its viewing time. I think that's exactly correct, because I think the fact that Amazon has attempted at least to some degree to be the cable bundle of the streaming world is that there are some streaming services that you can subscribe to through Amazon that are other subscribing services, and they have the full library of on-demand programming and stuff like that, which some of the, you know, which Netflix does not have. And so I think that's what's getting Amazon its part of that viewing time is not so much that people, well, very clearly not so much that people are eager to watch Lord of the Rings or Citadel, so much as people use their Amazon viewing platform to watch a lot of other things. Maybe it recommends that they watch Citadel at the end, and maybe they do. But I think that's the big distinction. But yeah, I'm probably a little bit surprised at how low Max is, at how low Disney Plus is, at the fact that Peacock, which doesn't really so much seem to be in the conversation at all, is roughly in the same grouping with them. There's a big amorphous blob at the bottom of streaming services that, you know, just waiting for something to differentiate itself. It's interesting. On a low level.
Number 5.
As usual, we wrap things up with the Critics' Corner. Among this week's major new launches, you've got Solar Opposites returning to Hulu without Justin Roiland. The Upshaws is back on Netflix, which also debuts the docuseries Depp vs. Heard. Craig Robinson's Killing It debuts its second season on Peacock. Amazon's got Harlan Coben's Shelter. And MGM Plus, the artist formerly known as Epix, launches The Winter King. Dan, what you got this week?
I mean, the simple answer would be absolutely nothing, and we can just move on to the closing credits. But, it, you know, nothing is ever that simple. You look at the schedule, and this is a light week. A lot of the stuff that's premiering, I reviewed Depth versus Herd. It's just completely pointless. There's nothing else I can say about it. Like if you followed the Johnny Depp Amber Heard defamation trial from last year, this was not a million years ago. If you followed it, all this is a compilation of clips and social media reactions with the very minor technological innovation that basically they edit together the testimony so that it becomes more literally he said, she said. It adds nothing to the discussion. It does not discover anything about the way that people behaved that was not already the thing that people were discussing at the time. People were already fascinated by the wide gap in online support between Johnny Depp and Amber Heard, and there were countless articles and things written about it. So for heaven's sakes, there is nothing here that you don't know if you paid attention. And if you didn't pay attention, you probably weren't paying attention for a very good reason, and you are probably much healthier now as a result of it. Why would you waste 3 hours to catch up on an uninformative version of something that happened last year that you didn't care about last year or avoided dealing with last year? There's absolutely no reason to watch at all. So that's Depth the Herd on Netflix. And then everything else this week, basically, I tried doing some sampling of things the past couple days just to be able to address things. And basically, I tried watching some of The Winter King and some of Shelter. I made it through one episode of The Winter King. Our colleague Angie Hahn wrote our review, and she was not hugely enthusiastic, so I don't feel like I didn't do it full justice, but since I wasn't reviewing it, I didn't feel bad about it. Basically, it's the latest kind of gritty historical retelling of the King Arthur legend based on the Bernard Cornwell series of novels. Look, there are people out there who love this scrappy, historical, but still aesthetically similar to Game of Thrones or Vikings or whatever version of these stories. And if you do, I think this probably is a serviceable version of that thing. It is fairly good looking and has a certain grit to it, but my appetite apparently just was not overwhelmingly there. And so I watched one episode and moved on. I am not going to say that it is a bad show, just that it did not hold my attention when it was not required to professionally. And so I moved on. I did better, honestly, with Harlan Coben's Shelter. I watched four episodes of that. It premieres on Amazon. I am not a Harlan Coben reader. I've periodically felt like I should be, but I have not been. And so I don't have the clear sense of the way that this fits in with his body of work. He's done multiple series, both with the Mickey Bolitar character, who's the teenage protagonist in this story, but also with his uncle, who apparently is a sports agent and stuff. So it's all kind of connected. Shelter it's a strange show because it's kind of YA, but kind of not. It's hard to tell in the first four episodes whether it's supposed to be supernatural, whether you're supposed to be taking aspects of it as heightened, whether it's supposed to be kind of in the vein of a Scooby-Doo or Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because there's absolutely a Scooby gang, a bunch of teenage kids who go poking around in a haunted house, people start going missing, etc., etc., etc. Sometimes it seems a little bit more corny than it should be, and it seems to have comedic elements that I don't know necessarily go together, especially since the story has a tangential Holocaust backstory, which is not necessarily a combination of tones that I love. But it throws a lot of mysteries at the screen, the young cast, which is led by Jaden Michael, who played young Colin Kaepernick in whatever the Netflix Ava DuVernay Colin Kaepernick series was. He's the lead. He's fairly likable in a lot of the supporting young actors. Adrian Greensmith is either going to really annoy or really entertain people. And I think I kind of went back and forth. I thought that a lot of the teenage actors were solid, sometimes a little on the wooden side. And then it's a really interesting supporting cast of adult actors. Constance Zimmer has the biggest supporting role, but you've got like Tova Felschuk in a major role. That's kind of amusing. Peter Reigert and Adrian Barbeau pop up in an episode. Lots of people where I'm just sitting there going, ooh, look who just popped up. I haven't seen that person in a long time. And whatever the mystery is, I was at least curious about it. I felt no regret about the 4 hours that I spent watching these episodes. It moves fairly well, fairly entertainingly, even if I couldn't exactly tell you what its tone really is supposed to be or what I'm supposed to be taking away from it. I suspect probably those things will become more clear as it goes along. I don't know if this is going to be a wild tonal deviation from the book series or if this is exactly what it is. And so people, you know, who have read the books are going to be like, this is exactly what I want, or if it's a violation, given that it's co-created by Harlan Coben. I assume that at least vaguely it's what he wanted it to be, Harlan Coben and Charlotte Coben. So yeah, I didn't mind it. And in a really, 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 really rough week for new programming, I found Shelter to be the most promising thing on TV this weekend, which is not the most enthusiastic of reviews. And also, some people really will like The Winter King. I have no questions of that at all. It just is not slash was not the thing that I was in the mode for at the time. So that's all I got this week.
For more of Dan's weekly recommendations, be sure to subscribe to The Hollywood Reporter's Now See This newsletter and bookmark thr.com/TV-reviews for more. That feels like a good place to wrap things up. Thank you, as always, for listening to TV's Top 5, The Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast.
You can subscribe to us on all of your various podcasting platforms. If you like us, rate us. If you really like us, write a little reviewy thing. They help spread the word of mouth. You can come say hi to us on various social media platforms where she is rather reliably Snoodit with two O's, and I am always The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And if you have questions for future mailbag segments, and apparently they're weekly now, so by future, I mean next week, you can email us at tvstop5@thr.com. Oh yes, that is still tvstop5, the numeral 5, at thr.com. Until next week, Leslie.
Until next week, Dan.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.